All right, good evening everyone. Welcome to 2000 Years, the Jewish Odyssey, Part 8. We'll be discussing tonight the 8th century. And again, I thank Becky Navi Katz for sponsoring Le'ilu Nishmas Yonah Ben Rav Aryeh Leg. By the 8th century, you're right, the 700s, the Byzantine Empire had shrunk and consisted of Asia Minor and Greece and parts of southern Italy. By contrast, the Muslim Empire, in just a little over a half century, had expanded across the entire world, encompassing land as far east as what's today Afghanistan and India, north into Bukhara and Armenia, the Middle East, all of North Africa, no one really wanted the rest of Africa, and all of Iberia with the conquest of Spain after or in the year 711. Now the Jews, who had been harshly persecuted by Spanish Christians, even expelled for a time in the 7th century, welcomed the Muslim conquerors as saviors. The Jews even aided the Muslims in their invasion. So there were reports that Toledo, which is a city in central Spain, was handed over by the Jews to the Muslims. This became the source, 7 centuries later, people have long memories, for the accusation of treason against the Jews by the Christians, that the Jews had facilitated the Muslim conquest. And now also, after the Muslim conquest in 711, many Jews returned from North Africa, to which they had been banished in the 7th century, to reside again in Spain. The land of Israel fell under Muslim rule in the 7th century, as we discussed. So in 691, the Caliph Abd al-Malik built a Dome of the Rock, at 691, a shrine over the Eben HaShisiyya on the Temple Mount, but he had another distinction as well. He, Abd al-Malik, founded the only town the Arabs ever established in the land of Israel through all the years of their rule, which is Ramla, next to Lod. That's the only town the Arabs ever built, meaning a new city or town from scratch. And that Abd al-Malik did in 716, for the best of reasons. Ramla was built at a crossroads, the intersection of the Egypt-Syria road, running north-south or southwest to northeast, and the Yerushalayim-Yafo road. It was right there where he built Ramla. If you recall, the first time I visited Israel in the late 60s, there was no major highway between Tel Aviv and Yerushalayim, so both the bus and the Sheirut always passed through Ramla on the way there. Now it's really a backwater. But Ramla then, from the 8th century on, became the regional capital of Muslim interests in the land of Israel. Never Yerushalayim, and was even called in shorthand in Arabic, Filastin, meaning Palestine. The city itself became representative, emblematic in the Arab mind for Palestine itself. It was identified as the quintessential Arab city, although it was actually then as now a mixed city of Arabs and Jews. The major industry in Ramla was actually a Jewish business, dyeing, meaning dyers, dyeing clothing and fabrics, etc. But that was their achievement, Ramla. All the other cities and towns in Israel were founded by Jews, a few by Byzantines. Most of them dated back from biblical times. Whatever the Arabs did, the Arabs and Muslims in their 13 centuries, was essentially built on what was built before, not to mention sometimes destroy what had been built before. The capital of the Muslim world was Damascus. I should mention one other thing. There was an article in the Jerusalem Post, it was about 2-3 weeks ago, that the latest findings show that the Dome of Iraq was actually built on top of a Byzantine church. We'll get back to later when the Crusaders come and they destroy the Dome of Iraq and build another church on top, and then again that was destroyed. But the original Dome of Iraq seems to have been built on the top of a church even then. Jews in Israel in the 8th century lived mainly in the Shomron and the north. They're clustered in villages in the Galil. They're major Jewish populations living in Yerushalayim, in Ashkelon, in Gaza, in Rafiach, in Hebron, in Susia, in Yafo. Also, Tveria was another Jewish city, but Tveria sustained heavy damage in a devastating earthquake that shook the Jordan Valley in 748. It was one of several earthquakes that would ravage Israel over the years. Israel, as we know, is situated right in the middle of the Syria-Africa Rift, known as the Great Rift Valley, a very steep drop from the mountains of Lebanon and Syria through the Dead Sea and southward. In fact, it's the steepest drop on Earth, so the tectonic plates are always shifting. It's actually situated on very unstable ground in more ways than one, I suppose. The largest Jewish population lived in the 8th century, as in the previous centuries, in Babel, and today is Iraq and Iran. And moreover, Babel was the spiritual center of world Jewry. It was not without its Jewish conflicts. Surprise, surprise. You'll recall that we last time learned about the Resh Galusa Bustanai, who had two wives, one Jewish-born and one Persian-born royalty, a princess that was given to him, the gift of a conquering Omar. And the bitter rivalry between the offspring of the two wives to succeed Bustanai as the Resh Galusa. So Bustanai's son, by his so-called Jewish wife, Chizdai, claimed the throne and demanded that the Gaonim recognize the progeny of the Persian princess as not Jewish, even though she had converted. This the Gaonim of Sura refused to do, and that won them the enmity of Chizdai, and his son Shlomo, who succeeded him in 689. Now, whereas Bustanai had left the Gaonim alone and even supported them, and Chizdai, because of this conflict, was a little more antagonistic, Shlomo attempted to usurp their power, and he began himself appointing the heads of the yeshivos in Sura and Pumbedisa, meaning he asserted the right to appoint the Gaonim on his own. In 719, Rav Shira Gaon reports in his Igeres that Mar Bar Yanka had married into the family of the Resh Galusa, exerted his authority, Atkif Morus al Rabbanon. He exerted his authority on the Rabbanon, the rabbis of Pumbedisa, and they all fled to Sura, meaning for this brief period of time, the yeshiva in Pumbedisa closed down. After his death, they returned to Pumbedisa. Why did they leave? Except for very rare cases, the Gaonim were never confrontational, because they didn't really hold any temporal or political power. They wielded spiritual power. Their influence was on the people more than it was on the rulership. Worse than that, in 730, Shlomo appointed a non-Surin as the Gaon in Sura. Usually the Gaonim had learned or taught in whatever yeshiva where they became Gaon. But Mar Shmuel of Pumbedisa, who was a distinguished lineage, descendant of Amemar, the famous Amora, he became the Gaon in Sura. Rav Shera never objected to any of this. He himself was a Pumbedisan, but the appointment was heavy-handed, showing the absolute authority that was wielded by the Resh Galusa. It did succeed, though, in establishing the preeminence of Sura during the 8th century as opposed to Pumbedisa. Now, among the writings of Mar Shmuel is another tshuva confirming the status of Bustanai's so-called Persian children as Jewish, converted kahalacha. Again, despite the fact that he was the Resh Galusa's appointee, and despite the fact that Resh Galusa wanted the opposite, he wanted a declaration these children were not Jewish at all, and therefore had no claim to the office of the Resh Galusa at all. In any event, the Gaonim were, for the most part, almost entirely, scrupulously ethical. Now, notwithstanding the tendencies of the Resh Galusa to be dictatorial, they did run into a certain problem and their authority receded. They were dictatorial primarily because, all right, they were descendants of Beis David, everybody recognized that, but primarily because the Muslims here ruled from Damascus. I mentioned that Ramla was the regional capital in Israel, but the overall capital of the Muslim Empire was in Damascus, and therefore the Resh Galusa and Babel had the approval of the caliphs, who were very distant and didn't take a direct hands-on interest in what was happening. So they were able to rule with an iron fist in a variety of spheres. Nevertheless, in the 8th century, their authority receded fairly rapidly. partly because the people always turned to the Gaonim for real leadership, especially spiritual leadership, and therefore they recognized the limitations of the Reish Galusa, but more because of what happened in 750. Everything changed abruptly. In 750, the 90-year rule of the Umayya dynasty ended, in warfare, of course, and it was replaced by the Abbasid dynasty, Abbas. The Umayyads had been relatively tolerant and open-minded and moderate in their religious practices. And of course, they centered themselves in Damascus, which was removed from the major Jewish population centers. And they were also content to expand their empire through global trade. But the Umayyads had suffered two major blows. First, in the year 717, and keep in mind, for 80 years, they're just expanding across the world. In 717, their invasion of Constantinople was repulsed, and therefore the Byzantine Empire, what was left of it, was spared. That was their first significant military defeat at the hands of Leo III, the Byzantine Emperor, who responded in true fashion by attempting to forcibly baptize all the Jews in his kingdom. But that was the first defeat of the Muslims in 717. In 732, we mentioned last time briefly, their defeat in the Battle of Tours in central France at the hands of Charles Martellus, Charles the Hammer. That defeat halted the Islamic advance into Europe once and for all. They undoubtedly would have captured all of Europe but for this defeat. Now, this Battle of Tours was a historic shift in the world's destiny. It was an epic battle, took just a few days, but an epic battle involving hundreds of thousands of soldiers, Muslim cavalry versus French infantrymen. You can't really say the French win wars, so they were Franks that weren't really French. And the well-trained Frank forces prevailed. The Muslim commander here, Abd al-Rahman, was captured and killed, and the remnant of his troops retreated to Spain. This actually, in 732, represented the high water mark of the Muslim advance into Europe. They'd gone as far as Tours is in central France, and with the Muslims, it's a sore point until today, because after that, it was a slow, sometimes not so slow, retreat into a much more retrenched Muslim world. So this was 732. Within two decades, the Umayyad dynasty had been overthrown by the Abbasid dynasty. They claimed that they were the rightful heirs to Muhammad from a different relation, I think an uncle of his. So the Umayyads were very summarily driven out of the Middle East, and they retained only their caliphate in Spain. Interestingly, both of these dynasties, the Umayyads and the Abbasids, endured in some form into the 20th century. Now the Abbasids were aided by non-Arab Muslims, to wit Persians, and after their victory in 750, they moved the capital of the Muslim Empire from Damascus to Baghdad, in other words, right in the heart of Jewish Babylon. So consequently, the Reish Galusa declined in authority, as the Arab rulers were no longer at a distance, but they were right there in the middle of Babel. According to most accounts, Sura, the great town, is a suburb. It's not far from Baghdad. Although the Reish Galusa's prestige dimmed, for the next three centuries, the Abbasids did not interfere with Jewish spiritual life in Babel and were fairly tolerant rulers. This was so because of a remarkable attitude of Islam. And I say remarkable because it contrasts so sharply to what's happening today. The Abbasids championed knowledge and progress, and they cited the hadith, that's the teachings of Muhammad that are not in the Quran, that read, quote, and again, we shudder by today's standards. The hadith said, "The ink of scientists is more holy than the blood of martyrs." Well, I didn't make that up. That came from Muhammad, but unfortunately, the ink must have been blurred over the years, because I don't know anybody who says that anymore today. But the very phrase, "the ink of scientists is more holy than the blood of martyrs," tells us how the Abbasids placed their priorities in the world. During their three centuries of prominence, the Muslim world then became the intellectual center for science, philosophy, medicine, education, mathematics. For example, the fundamentals of algebra, it even sounds Arabic, and it is, were introduced in an Arabic book in 820. Even though algebra itself is of ancient origin, but the book that codified it and produced the first formulas and became the basic text and gave the name algebra, algorithm, which are both Arabic, that came because of the progress that existed now in the Muslim world. They even established in Baghdad what they called the House of Wisdom, where both Muslim and non-Muslim scholars, including Jews, attempted to translate the world's knowledge into Arabic. So all citizens of Arabia would have access to the world's reservoir of knowledge. Jews benefited, of course, from such an environment, and this will be seen even more in the first philosophical interactions between Jews and Muslims that became renowned in Rav Saggia's time, a century and a half ahead. But along with the political decline of Islam's influence, the loss of this goal, the pursuit of knowledge, which would happen in the last millennium, and their regression behind the Western world, so that's a primary source of the discontent that agitates the Muslim world today. They should be much more advanced in a variety of spheres than they are, and they see the world making progress around them, and in fact even a substantial ungodly amount of oil wealth has not really turned the tide in their countries. In this fertile atmosphere in Bavel, a new and historic development took place, the publication of the first Sfarim after the Talmud. Until now, the Jews had the Tanakh and the Mishnah, and then the Talmud. Rav Achai Gon was a student of Rav Shmuel Bar Rav Mar, the Gaon of Pumbedisa, and he, Rav Achai Gon, was the natural successor of Rav Shmuel in Pumbedisa. But when Rav Shmuel died in the early 750s, the Reish Galusa appointed Rav Achai's student, Rav Natrai, as the Gaon for unknown reasons. Rav Shreira simply writes, after Rav Natrai was appointed, Uveyome Selek Rav Acha Mishabcha Eretz Yisrael. In his day, Rav Achai Gaon left Bavel, went to Eretz Yisrael, because Rav Natrai Shamehava, he was Rav Achai Gaon's student. It worked out well in the end because Rav Achai Gaon, who by the way wasn't really a Gaon in the sense that he didn't head one of the yeshivas, so he was a Gaon Lishma. He was called a Gaon because of his Torah scholarship. He went to Eretz Yisrael and he strengthened Jewish life there, and probably in the late 750s or thereabouts, he produced the first post-Talmudic halachic work called the She'iltos, known today as the She'iltos Rav Achai Gaon, which Shultos are questions, but what he did is he assimilated questions from all over the world, and then in the Shultos, he based it on the weekly Sedra. So Jews would be Madra Sedra, they would be able to look at, in the Shultos, they'd read the Sedra, and in the Shultos they'd get some halacha, or Erev halacha, that comes out of the Shultos, by chance. That's what Rabbi Talvis does here every week. He extracts from the Sedra something that halacha, some area of halacha, that seems to be loosely connected to the Sedra. And he would answer the question that came to him as well, enabling the Jews who would review the Sedra to gain knowledge of halacha as well. It's still extant. I mean, I have a copy of the Shultos at home, so it's a work of the 8th century. It was the first major work of the Netziv of Volozhin in the 19th century was his commentary on the Shiltos called the Hamek Shelah. And through the Netziv, his super commentary on the Shiltos, it became even more popular in the Jewish world. And it still has some popularity. I never davened in the shul, but I know when I grew up in Muncie, Rabbi Tendler every Friday night in shul would have a shiur on the Shiltos of Rav Achai Gaon with the commentary of the Netziv. Like I give a Dvar Halacha, he would learn the Shiltos every week. As an example, so this week's Sedra is Vayechi. Vayechi discusses the deaths of Yaakov and Yosef. So the question of the Shiltos is on the topic of Matna Shchiv Meira, a deathbed gift. All the halachos from Baba Basra, that a deathbed gift, meaning a gift of someone on his deathbed, not someone who gifts a deathbed to someone else, but a gift of someone on his deathbed, does not follow the normal modes of distribution of property, in terms of kinyonim, the modes of acquisition. Matanasa matana, if he gives a gift, the gift is a gift, even if the same gift given by a healthy person would not be effective in transferring ownership. For example, metaltalin, if you want to give someone a gift of a pen, he has to actually do mashiach, has to take the pen into his possession. But if a goseis, if a shchiv meir on his deathbed takes his pen and says, give it to Joe, then it becomes Joe's pen, even if Joe does not make a kinyan on it. So in the Sefer Vayechi, in the Shiltos, Rabbi Chai Gaon goes through all the halachos of Matna Shchiv Meira and other halachos of Yerusha. It's written in Aramaic, which tends to the conclusion that he actually wrote it while he was living in Eretz Yisrael. Aramaic being the language there, most of the later Svarim that came out of Bavel at this time were written in Arabic. The Shiltos of Chai Gaon was often cited by the Rishonim, Tosfos, Rashi quotes it even once. So too the Halachos Psukos, also in the late 750s. Rabbi Yehudai Gaon was taken from Pumpadisa, and he too was made the Gaon of Sura. His students wrote the first pure halachic guide, halacha, in the 760s, detailing in subject form the halacha, just omitting the Gemara's discussion. Now this work is not as well known as what followed very shortly thereafter, the Halachos Gedolos of Rav Shimon Kayara, who learned in Sura, better known as the Bahag. The Bahag already became very famous because he's quoted all the time by the Rishonim. The Halachos Gedolos was another compilation of halachos, but he followed the order of the Talmud, so Halachos Gedolos is a little more systematic than the Halachos Psukos. But also, very importantly and historically, the Bahag wrote in the Halachos Gedolos the very first compilation of the Taryag Mitzvos, the 613 commandments. So tradition teaches us that there are Taryag, there are 613s, the Gemara at the bottom of Chav Gimel and Beis and Chav Dal Amar Aleph in Makos. We have a tradition that we have 613 commandments, but what exactly they are, how you enumerate them, is subject to dispute. So the Bahag was the very first to weigh in this area. And later generations had to reckon with his count, in many cases saying why they disagree. That a certain entity, so for example, the Bahag is unique, almost singular, in saying that Hallel, the recitation of Hallel, is a mitzvah d'oraisa, based on the Gemara and Pesachim, that they said Hallel at Kriyas Yamsuf. Whatever. Others disagree, most disagree, said just Mitzvah d'Rabbanon. But nonetheless, all subsequent compilations of the Targ Mitzvos had to reckon with the Bahag. Now all of these were products of the 8th century and gave Jews even more to learn. It made the study of Torah a little more systemized. Each generation made Talmud Torah more vibrant, and as the books spread across the world, the Torah itself became more entrenched and more a topic of conversation. There was always something new that was being added to the corpus of Talmud Torah, so Jews would always have the next Sefer to look forward to. Even though, of course, keep in mind, everything is handwritten. It's not as if they were mass-produced, but nonetheless, there were enough works to keep the flow of Torah. With the Muslim rulers tolerant of Jews, most of our problems will be caused by ourselves. After the death of the Reish Galusa, Shlomo served many years, some say 30 years, some say 60 years, Bustanai's grandson in 759, after he died, so none of his sons were judged by the caliph to be fit for leadership. Or others say simply that he died childless. Still others hold that he had a son named Yitzchak, and that son died childless after a brief reign. In any event, the caliph turned to the Gaonim for advice, the aforementioned Yehudai Gaon and Rav Dodai Gaon. Shlomo, or Yitzchak, had two nephews, Anan ben David and Hananiah ben David, the Gaonim recommended to the caliph that he appoint the younger, Hananiah, as the Reish Galusa, not trusting Anan's religious commitment, and the caliph duly appointed Hananiah as the Reish Galusa. Anan refused to accept this. He declared himself the Reish Galusa. Arabs being Arabs, he was promptly arrested, tried for rebellion, and sentenced to execution. In prison, there was a jailhouse lawyer, a Muslim rebel named Abu Hanifa, who himself was in prison because he was spouting Muslim heresies, known as reforms. He advised Anan very cleverly to claim that he could not be rebellious because he represents a separate religion, and so he could therefore not be guilty of usurping the office of Reish Galusa. He simply represents a different faith community. And he proved it, Anan did, by mounting his defense and resurrecting the movement of the Tzedukim that had denied the oral law and the Masorah from Sinai, and Anan called his followers Karaim from Mikra, only followed the Tanakh, and so was born the Karaite movement that endures until today. So with this defense, oddly enough, Anan was freed, jailhouse lawyers, sometimes effective, and Anan even became a favorite of the Muslim rulers. He advocated major changes in Jewish life. He claimed, as others have also, the Torah had been distorted by the rabbis. He changed the way Shabbos was observed. He reverted for a time to a lunar calendar based on Pi Edim. He had his own witnesses testify to when they saw the new moon for Rosh Chodesh. He denied the literal application of the mitzvos of tefillin or mezuzah. He said they're just metaphors. And that, in fact, dovetailed nicely with the Muslim interpretation of mitzvos, because they too maintain that the Torah is metaphorical, and he had other such heresies as well. Now, this rejection of the Masorah from Sinai is actually a perennial. It's represented in our day very well by the Reform and Conservative movement. So, the truth be told, the Karaites, unlike the Reform, never denied the divine origin of the Torah. They accepted Torah min HaShemayim. So in fact, they're on a different level altogether. And they became a force. At their height, estimates are that 10% of world Jewry in the 10th, 11th centuries were Karaites. Now, it sounds like a lot until we consider that in our day, we're maybe 10 or 15% of world Jewry. So it's the exact opposite. But nonetheless, at the time, it was very substantial. The giants of future eras, like Rav Sajigo and the Rambam, they would go on the offensive against the Karaites. Many Jews would be swept away. Certain practices would become popular in Jewish life as a challenge to the Karaites, as a result, really, of the Karaite rebellion and a demonstration of our faith. Famously, Ner Shabbos, which was originally enacted for Shalom Bayis. That's how the Gemara understands it. She needs a light in the house for Shalom Bayis. That's Ner Shabbos. Now, in the 8th century, it took on a different dimension to it. It was an attack on the Karaites to have a candle burning on Shabbos, because they maintained, as is well known, the Torah says, Lo savaru esh b'chol mos rosechem b'yom ha-Shabbos. You can't have any fire lit in your house at all on Shabbos. Not as we understand it, you can't kindle the light on Shabbos. They maintain that there can't be any light on Shabbos. So having a light, a near Shabbos, that became a defiant act, or really an act that identified a person as part of the community of the Masorah, and not a Karaite. Centuries later, it became customary, the Gemara has it also, but it became more popular to eat, to dafka eat hot food on Shabbos. Also, because the Karaites could not have had food, like cholent became popular in the Ashkenazic world. Now, Karaites still exist in Eretz Yisrael. They number about 10,000. They're centered in that city, Ramla, and also Ashdod. There is one Karaite shul in the United States, a suburb of, where else? San Francisco. As it is, over the centuries, there has been the development of the Karaite literature to explain what they do, a little darshaning as well, as it's impossible to interpret the Torah coherently without one, but much of that literature is no longer extant. What's their status today? It's hard to say. They remain a separate sect. Originally, they were treated by the Israeli government as a separate religion, allowed to have their own courts, their own marriage, divorce, etc. But in more recent years, the Rabbanut has ruled that for the most part, they are Jews. For a time, they required them to undergo, for marriage purposes, a pro forma conversion, similar to what the Ethiopians did. But even now, in recent years, that's been abandoned. There are some famous individuals that were Karaites. One I saw, you recall from our study of the history of Israel, the Egyptian spy ring in the 1950s that was captured and precipitated the Lavon affair. One of the spies was Moshe Marzouk, an Egyptian Jew. He happened to have been an Egyptian Karaite and not a Jew, but in the publicity, they always called him a Jew, so we shouldn't think he was anything different. Nevertheless, their issues are not completely resolved even today. Undoubtedly, Mamzerim proliferate in their midst due to non-compliance with our laws of Gittin for now 13 centuries, 14 centuries, but they do exist. There were two immediate consequences of the Karaite heresy. One is that it weakened for a time the authority of the Gaonim, who now had to deal with this internal crisis, meaning they had a rival poskim, the poskim of the Karaites. And secondly, it weakened, probably permanently, the office of the Reish Galusa. From the Muslim perspective, the Jewish community now was irrevocably split, and so the Reish Galusa did not represent all Jews. He did not represent all Jews. He was no longer a powerful force that had to be treated deferentially. So their power and influence waned because of the Karaites, because of the proximity of Muslim rule now in Baghdad, and because after the death of Hananiah in 770, the Gaonim chose as his successor Zakkai bar Achonai, who was the first Reish Galusa to be the descendant of Bustanai's so-called Persian wife. Rav Shreira Gaon refers ambiguously to a simultaneous appointment by Rav Malka of the Reish Galusa of Natronai, who was deposed in favor of Zakkai. So it wasn't a very happy scene. It was a community in conflict with itself. At the same time, they're in conflict with the Karaites. But from then on, until the end of the office of the Reish Galusa in 1039, the Reish Galusa would always be the progeny of the so-called Persian wife. And the pendulum swung again. When the Reish Galusa, or the office of the Reish Galusa, deteriorated, the stature of the Gaonim was strengthened, and the people looked to the Torah leadership for their authority and guidance. And fortunately, the Gaonim provided it with timely takanos that both shaped Jewish life as well as reflected the changes that were happening in Jewish life. Most significantly, major change in Jewish life. In the 8th century, most Jews across the world, but certainly in Bavel, were no longer farmers. This was an historic shift because the Torah, remember, was given to an agrarian society. The laws of the Talmud reflected life in an agrarian society, and that would end in the 8th century, when more Jews became traders and merchants, craftsmen, and professionals. And that is also endured until today. The move actually started in the previous century, when the early Muslim rulers began to levy high taxes on landowners. So it became cheaper not to own land. They would sell the land to Persians or Babylonians, and then invest the money in business. So new regulations had to be enacted. Most famously, in 786, the Gaonim decreed that debts, like the debt of the Ksuba, could now be collected also from the Taltalin, from movables, and not just karkos, not just real estate. Now that change is also reflected in our Ksuba today, but keep in mind, the halacha was that the debt of a ksuba, the money a husband owed to a wife in case of his death, those 200 zuz, had to be paid out of his assets. If he didn't have any assets, it had to be paid out of any real property he may have owned during the marriage. So for example, if land was sold during a marriage, it was as if the wife had a lien, a mortgage on that land until the obligation of the ksuba was satisfied. And it would only be for karkos, for real estate. It was preferred as collateral because real estate is not going anywhere. It's always there. Even Bernie Madoff can't steal real estate. And there could also be title checks. That's what it was. You would record that this person, husband A, sold land, but the land is indebted, at least to the extent of 200 zuz, to pay off a debt that is owed, that potentially is owed to his wife. You couldn't do that with movables, because Chazal felt it would be too much of an encroachment on commerce if every time you sold chattel, there would be an outstanding lien from the wife. Like, I sold my pen to my friend, and then years later, the wife comes and claims it back. He wants it back to pay off the debt of the ksuba. Must be some fancy pen. But now, since fewer Jews own land, the Gaonim, based on a provision in the Gemara that said in a society where Jews don't own land, it can be done, the Gaonim expanded the provision in the Gemara that allowed for liens on movables as well. And that's in existence until today too. In this way, the Gaonim, like Chazal generally, were able to respond to new situations with a timely halachic remedy. In any event, the transformation endured that Jewish farming became almost non-existent to the extent that the very idea of Jewish farmers, for example, such as would arise in 19th century Russia or the land of Israel, was had to be a quixotic, almost amusing endeavor that Jews will be able to till the soil. So much had things changed in 12 centuries, whereas historically, for a millennium and a half, Jews were only farmers. In all, 18 Gaonim ruled in Pumbedisa in the 8th century and 12 in Sura. But there was life elsewhere in the world as well. Most Jews lived in Bavel, but there were several important communities and developments elsewhere that would be either very, very interesting or critical, crucial, as Bavel began its slow decline. One of the more exotic developments in the 8th century involved a tribe located in the Caucasus known as the Khazars. The Khazars were nomads who settled on the Caspian Sea in the 7th century, fought off Muslim invaders, fought them off again, the Umayyads, in the 730s, and they then ruled over a tremendous expanse of territory, most of what is today southern Russia. In the year 740, of all things, the kingdom adopted Judaism as its state religion, and some or all of the Khazars converted, possibly to stake out their permanent independence from the Umayyads, possibly to carve out an independent entity hedged in, as they were, between Muslims and Christians. For 3 centuries after that, every king of Khazaria had to be Jewish. Now, how this came about is something of a mystery, although the existence of such a Jewish kingdom is a fact. The kingdom was popularized in the 11th century by Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's famous work, the Sefer HaKuzari, in which he describes a non-Jewish king invites a philosopher, a Christian, and a Muslim for dialogue, asks them certain theological questions, and then points out the inconsistencies and logical flaws in their arguments. Confounded, an aide suggests he call in a rabbi, a member of the persecuted group, that nonetheless, their texts have been referred to constantly by the Christian and the Muslim. So the king calls in the rabbi in a long dialogue. The rabbi answers all the king's questions, and the king and his subjects convert to Judaism. Now, this is certainly not a contemporaneous account of Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi, and it's arguable whether it's even true, whether it even happened in that fashion. The sources differ. What is indisputable is that there was a king named Bulan who did convert in the 8th century, around the year 740, along with his subjects. And for the next three centuries, they interact. Their paths cross, Jews across the world. Reb Sajigon refers to them favorably. The Karaites refer to them unfavorably because I suppose many were pious Jews. Persian and North African Jews saw them as heroes, Jews with a tood, ready to mix it up because they were a warring tribe. And so they were a very useful counterweight to their Muslim overseers. Indeed, the Khazars did negotiate on occasion on behalf of foreign Jews and even retaliated for mistreatment of their fellow Jews in other lands. So for example, in 920, a shul in Iran was destroyed. The Khazar king toppled the minaret of the mosque in his capital in Khazaria as a warning to the Iranians that they should not mess with any other shuls. Why did he topple the minaret and not just destroy the mosque? You can only do so much. And the argument was that by the time, before the mosque even fell, they would have destroyed all the shuls in Iran. So it was just to send a warning, which in fact worked. Because it's such an unlikely story, although true, the existence of the Khazar tribe of Jews has engendered theories among our detractors that we are all descendants of the Khazar converts, all Jews today, and therefore have no claim at all to the land of Israel. That, of course, is preposterous. It was, with DNA testing, it's demonstrably false, but it lingers. Arafat was very fond of citing it, and other such evil madmen as well. Eventually, in the 10th century, the Khazars fell to the conquering Vikings, who themselves lost to the Eagles yesterday, and the tribe of Kievan Rus, note the names, because the Kievan Rus tribe gave rise both to Russia, gave its name also to Russia, and to Kiev as well. The Khazars then scattered, many joined Jewish communities in Poland and Ukraine, and just blended in. So it was good while it lasted, certainly the novelty of it. Let's move westward. When the Muslims conquered Spain in 711, they did more than rid the country of its Christians. They also freed its Jews from an oppressor. Jews had lived in Spain probably since the end of the first Beis Hamikdash. To Machlokas, when the Novi Ovadia, in Chazon Ovadia, towards the end of that parak, refers to Galus Yerushalayim Asher B'Sfarad, so Rashi comments that this refers to Spain. And the previous statement, Agulus Achela said, to Tzarfat, he says means France as well. Others disagree, but it's clear that Jewish residence there dated almost a millennium already. Now, after the Muslim conquest, Jews would assume a greater, more active role in government, certainly, than under the Christians. The Muslim invaders, again, just like in Bavel, had no real interest or talent in administration, and so they eagerly embraced the Jews as ideal for these tasks and delegated much of governance to Jews. In the coming centuries, something else would happen. Politicians and businessmen would realize that Jews of all nations had family across the world, and that they could trust each other and could use their contacts for both diplomacy and trade, that a Jew in Spain and a Jew in Bavel had something essential in common that would not exist amongst any other nation. And so Jews became useful intermediaries in many different spheres of life for these kings. What happened in Spain in the 8th century was duplicated then also in France and Germany and Italy. The famous emperor Charlemagne means Charles the Great, he lived from 742 to 814. Charlemagne, known as King of the Franks, he was the son of Pepin the Short and the grandson of Charles Martellus, who won the Battle of Tours. Charlemagne conquered most of Western Europe and he became known as the father of Europe because he reversed Christianity's decline relative to Islam. Charlemagne restored to Christendom an appreciation of knowledge and culture and art. It had become a very sedated Christian world, and he revived it. Charlemagne's reign begins the recorded history of Ashkenazi Jews in Europe. For example, his prohibition of Christians lending money on interest opened the field to Jewish moneylenders, who greatly strengthened the economy of Europe through their moneylending and simultaneously became the target of legendary Christian hatred for it. Jews in France became exporters. For a time, the only trade between Europe and Asia was between Jews and on both ends of the world. Charlemagne even sent a Jew, name is known to us as Isaac, on a diplomatic mission to the Caliph of Baghdad in 797. Mind you, Charlemagne didn't love Jews as much as he loved what Jews could do for him. But that type of relationship in the exile is not to be dismissed out of hand. We can go quite far with it. Charlemagne did promulgate special laws right before his death, limiting Jews' transactions in currency, in wine, and in litigation, couldn't sue Christians. But all in all, he spurred the growth of the Jewish community in Europe. He was a Roman Catholic. He wasn't too frum. He had at least 10 wives and concubines and about 20 children. So between the wives and concubines and the children, it was a very freilich household. But that was a good combination for that period of time, to be Roman Catholic, but not too frum. He is a legendary figure, very historic figure. His three grandsons essentially divided between them France, Germany, and Italy. And their histories follow from the grandsons of Charlemagne. So just to summarize, the 8th century, certainly as we come to a close, has a very modern ring to it. Jews left agriculture, became businessmen and traders and professionals, began migrating to Western Europe. We published Svarim, the Shiltos, Halachos Gedolos, that sustained generations and are still in use today. We weathered the change in empires in the Muslim world, weathered as well the European wars. We dwelled in Israel in small numbers, but in a stable community, witnessing then the only Muslim city that would ever be established in the land of Israel, Ramallah. And we confronted in our world heresies, deviationist movements, and strife. It all sounds very familiar, especially the part about strife, which would embroil the Jews of Babel in the 9th century, hasten their decline, and within a very short time, shift the focus of Jewish life elsewhere, away from Babel. All that next week in the 9th century. I thank you very much.